To talk about some of the issues that revolve around saving a life on Shabbos, the laws of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos. What I'd like to talk about today is the last piece of that conversation, which is the different categories of Cholim on Shabbos. Do we assume that you're allowed to do anything for anybody who feels even slightly sick or remotely sick on Shabbos? Or do we say that there is a distinction between how sick somebody is? And even if you have somebody who is incredibly ill and is in a threat and a peril to their lives, would we assume that you're only allowed to do life-saving activity for them? Or would you assume that we expand that to allow us to do other things as well that may not have to do with the actual saving of lives? So as we'll see, it's a very relevant and important question. Let us try to break it down. Let's try to understand where this comes from and what it's all about. So we mentioned in our first year on this topic that obviously when one is faced with a problem on Shabbos that is potentially life-saving, obviously you need to violate Shabbos and save a life. Not only when it's a vadei pikuach nefesh, not only when you certainly are going to be able to save a life, but even when it's only a safek pikuach nefesh, even when we're not exactly sure, if someone is in doubt, you err on the side of caution and you save a life. So much so that the halacha is that if somebody claims on Shabbos that they don't want to be brought to the hospital because they want to be careful about Shabbos, we don't listen to them. Ain Shomilo, we don't accept what they are saying. We take them even against their own wishes. There was a story of a woman in Eretz Yisrael who had a child on Shabbos and did not want to go to the hospital. So she did a home birth, which was not expected at all. And her husband came to shul and asked for an aliyah. So the rabbi asked him, when did your wife have a baby? He said, just 2 hours ago. So how are you back already? So he said, well, we had the baby at home and we'll go to the hospital after Shabbos. He said, no, you don't get an aliyah. You go home immediately. Take your wife and your child to the hospital. Make sure everything's okay. We'll talk about an aliyah another time, and that's so obvious, it shouldn't have to be said, but it's something that is very, very important. Sometimes people take things into their own hands and assume that everything's fine, everything's going to be okay, but really we should not be taking chances at all. Even for a safek pikuach nefesh, we would violate Shabbos as well. So that is the first bracket, that is the first category of chol b'Shabbos, where it's obvious that somebody's life could potentially be in danger. The opposite extreme is what the Pischei Tshuva in Yerudea quotes in the name of the Chasam Sofer. What does he write in the name of the Chasam Sofer? That sometimes you have a situation which is Echad Mine Elef Alfe Alefe. One in a million times it's going to be dangerous. But the rest of the times, it's not dangerous at all. So, for example, I've said this before in public, and I got feedback from people who were at the shir, that it's a bad example. I'm not medically inclined enough to know what a good example would be. But the example my father always gave in shir was, if you have somebody who has an ingrown toenail. So, is it possible that that can get infected and it can turn out to be something that is life-threatening? Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. So somebody didn't like that example because they said if you are maybe a diabetic, could it be? That's more problematic? I don't know. They said for whatever reason, an ingrown toenail is a horrible example because it is very dangerous if you have this kind of condition. Okay, barring that condition, whatever it is. For most people who don't have an underlying precondition that makes an ingrown toenail very dangerous, if you would have an ingrown toenail on a Tuesday morning, you would not go to the hospital. You would stay home, you would either treat it yourself or make an appointment in the next couple of days and have it taken care of. So now, just because it happens to be Shabbos and I'm not going to work and I have nothing else to do, so, oh, let me drive to the hospital. No. Chasam Sofer says, since that is a case of Echad Mine Elef Alfei Alafim, that is a case which is so unlikely, which is so improbable to ever turn into a situation which is even dangerous, that would be something that we would not allow Chilul Shabbos for at all. So that's the opposite extreme. And then you have a very interesting scenario where it's somewhere in the middle. So my father talks about the example. In Europe, there were people who were afraid by World War I. They were afraid that if they weren't going to be Mechal Shabbos to go get some kind of papers and get out of the army, get out of the draft, they were concerned, we're not up to this yet, they were concerned that it's going to lead to a Pikuach Nefesh situation. So they walked into the Chafetz Chaim's home in Raden, and they asked him, what should we do? Chafetz Chaim said, absolutely, you should be Mechal Shabbos, sign the papers, travel, go to the train, do whatever you need to do to get the paperwork taken care of. 5 minutes later, there was another group of people that came in and said, you know, we're facing the draft, we have these issues, we're concerned about it, but you know, the truth is, we really don't think this is going to turn out to be anything problematic for us. You know, there's a concern in the back of our minds, but it's not really something that we think is so urgent. Chafetz Chaim said, absolutely not. You're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos. So the Talmidim turned to the Chafetz Chaim and said, we were just here 5 minutes ago, and the other students who were here asked you the same question, and he told them, be Mechal Shabbos, do what you have to do, sign the papers, And suddenly you have this new group of students who came in and you told them the opposite conclusion. So what is the difference? And the Chafetz Chaim answered, the difference is when you have a middle ground, when you have a situation which is slightly ambiguous, it's not clear whether or not it's actually a dangerous situation, it's not clear whether or not it's something that we really have to be concerned about, so then the Chafetz Chaim and the Chazon Ish argue that that really is dependent on the person and how they feel. If you feel concerned, not because you're being unreasonable, but because some of the people that would have this situation confronting them would be concerned, they would be nervous, and therefore if that's the kind of personality that you are, if that's how you feel, then yes, it's justified to be Mechal HaShabbos. If on the other hand, you're like others who are not concerned at all and you're very calm about the situation, then, said the Chafetz Chaim, there would be no heter at all. So again, these are the three categories. We have number one, a pikuach nefesh situation, or even a safek pikuach nefesh. So once you say safek pikuach nefesh, so then you're going to say, really? Any safek? So even a ingrown toenail, which could be a safek, you know, in some remote possibility, the answer is no. That's the opposite extreme. That would not be something that we would allow Chilul Shabbos for. And then you have the middle ground, which is something which some people are not, and that the Chazon Ish and the Chafetz Chaim argue is really dependent on the individual and how they feel about the situation that they are confronted with. Now, how far are we allowed to be Mechal HaShabbos for a person whose life is actually in danger? We're talking about the first category. A real pikuach nefesh. You have somebody who is on active chemotherapy, somebody who's in the ICU, somebody who's really not well at all, completely unstable, we don't know what's going to happen. So obviously we need to do life-saving activities for whatever is necessary. But how far does that go? So what do you mean how far does it go? Let's say the person is requesting of me to do something that has nothing at all to do with the life-saving treatment that they need, which happens all the time. Take, for example, you have a patient in the hospital who's, as we said, on active chemotherapy in the ICU. So what kind of treatment do they need that's life-saving? So what they need is, number one, they need to have the chemotherapy. They need to make sure all the machines are doing what they're supposed to do, that the IV line is in. All of that has to be taken care of, and that, of course, will be Mechal HaShabbos for. What happens when the patient turns to me and says, you know, just a little bit uncomfortable, can you move the bed? Can you adjust it? You know, my head is not sitting right, my body just doesn't feel comfortable, can you move it slightly in order that I should be a little bit more comfortable? Well, that entails Chilul Shabbos on my part. Would I be allowed to do that when it's clear that that's really not contributing at all to the betterment of the prognosis? The only thing I'm doing is making the patient feel a little bit more comfortable. Is that justifiable on Shabbos or perhaps not? So that's a very important question. Let's look here in the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos Kuf Chav Ches Amud Beis. So the Gemara here tells us, if you see here on the top, Tana Rabbana, Im Haisa Tzricha Laner. If you have a woman who is in active labor, and while she's in the middle of this active labor, while the child is being born, she calls out to the doctors and nurses and says, you know, I need the lights on, I need the lights on. Haisa Tzricha Laner, if she needs the lights on. So then we're told, Chaverta Madlekes La'azaner. Then of course, the people who are in the room will turn the lights on. Ask the Gemara, of course you turn the lights on. What's the question? The woman is having a baby. We need to have the lights on. So if she says turn the lights on, then we will. Says the Gemara, Lo Tzricha B'suma. We're talking about a woman who's blind. Woman who's blind, so why is she telling us to turn the lights on? Ma'u detema, I would have thought. Kivin de lo chazi aser. Since it's not going to make any difference to her if the lights are on or off. She can't see regardless. So what is the permissibility for me to turn the lights on for a woman who can't see anyway? Says the Gemara, it's a mistake to think that way. Because Isuva miyasva daita. Savra, she thinks, Iika midi chazia chaverta v'abdila. So the Magen Avraham explains as follows. What it means is, we're talking about a situation where a woman cannot see. She's blind. But the doctors can see just fine. And the lights are on. But the woman thinks that there's not enough light for them. It's not based on reality. It's just what she feels. And because of that, she's nervous. So she's requesting of the people in the room, you know, there's not enough light in here. Please turn on the lights. Please light a few more candles. We all look at each other and say, we don't know what she's talking about. Everything's fine. This is the way we do a delivery every day of the week. So a woman is requesting us to do something that is totally unjustified medically. There's no reason to be doing it other than the fact that isuva miyasva daitem, it's going to calm her fears. If we tell her, yes, we listen to your request, we're not going to start arguing with her whether it's medically sound or not, but we listen to her request and we light the candle on Shabbos, not because we need it, but because we need to help her calm herself down. And that is a very important halacha. What you see is that for the sake of calming the nerves of a patient, we'd be willing to do a melacha de'araisa. We'd be permitted to light a candle, to turn the lights on, even though we all know, all the medical professionals in the room are very well aware of the fact that this is doing absolutely nothing to contribute to the situation at hand medically. And that is a tremendous chiddush. That is a very important chiddush. So it has to be reasonable, though. I remember I was once talking to Rav Asher Weiss, and he gave an example. He said, imagine you have a woman who's in labor on Shabbos. So Hatzalah goes to pick her up, and they're going to drive her to the hospital. She's in a tremendous amount of pain. She says, you know, it would give me a lot of comfort if you drove by the shul and picked up my husband on the way. It would help me a lot. So what will the Hatzalah do if they have time? Of course they're going to do that. Why? Because that's the same as what the Gemara says here, that you're allowed to light the candle, so then we're going to stop off and pick up her husband. What if she says, okay, now that we have my husband, let's go pick up my mother? Well, okay, reasonable. Some women feel that they also want their mothers there. I don't know. Maybe some do, some don't. Doesn't make a difference. But if she feels that that would really give her comfort, we would do that. Then when you're done with that, she says, you know, I'd actually appreciate, why don't we go rent a bus, pick up the whole block? It would help me if we actually took all the kids and all the adults along with us and had like a whole big entourage in the hospital that was going to help encourage me to do this labor properly. So it has to be within reason. It's a little bit ridiculous to say such a thing, that we should be able to rent a bus and pick the whole neighborhood up on Shabbos. But in theory, if that's what the woman really sincerely felt that she needed in order to calm herself down, we would allow that as well. But again, it has to be something that is within reason. But I think this is a very important halacha in general when we talk about what we're willing to do for a chola sheyesh basakana. A woman in active labor is, by all criteria, a chola sheyesh basakana. So many things can go wrong, not only for her, but also for the unborn child. And obviously there's so much at play there, and everything needs to be done properly, and we have to go to the extreme to make sure that she is comfortable and that the situation is under control. And therefore we would treat Shabbos the same way we would during the week. The doctor should not be skimpy on his treatment of the patient. The doctor has to do whatever he would do on a regular Shabbos as well. As I mentioned, Rav Asher Weiss actually, on Shabbos, when he was by us, alluded to this for those who were there, but he didn't really give the details of the Shaila. But really, the Shaila was a very tragic one, but a very interesting application of this halacha as well. Now, it's not something that's linear. It doesn't go across to every single case. You have to understand the dynamics of each shayla on its own and then try to really decipher what the halacha should be. So unfortunately, there was a terrible, terrible bus accident a couple of weeks ago in Yerushalayim. I think there were two in a row, 1 week and then the next week, where a bus just spiraled out of control and a number of people were injured. A couple of people were killed as well. Terrible, terrible scene, terrible story. So one of the women who was killed was a young woman, who was injured, was a young woman who was married for 6 months. She was so severely injured, she ended up in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, and she was in a coma, and they had to amputate both of her legs. A terrible tragedy. They had to amputate both of her legs. And her husband called with the following shayla. Her husband called her Asher Weiss and said, his wife was a nida at the time of the accident. Obviously, she's not going to go to the mikveh. So he said, when they wake up his wife and take her off the sedation, and she wakes up to this trauma of seeing that she's lost both of her legs, a 22-year-old woman, such a terrible tragedy, is he allowed to cradle his wife? Is he allowed to hold her in order that there should be less trauma? Obviously, the situation is going to be horrifying whenever it happens and whoever is there. But can he at least cradle his wife, even though she's a nida? Is he allowed to do that in order to minimize the amount of trauma that she's going to have when she's taken off the sedation? That was the shayla. And again, a lot of what it's based on, a lot of what the answer is based on, is what you see here in Hilchos Shabbos. Look how far we're willing to go, not for the medical treatment of a chola sheyesh basakana, but even for the yisuv hadaita, even just for the psychological or emotional well-being of a patient, is something that we also need to take into very careful consideration. Now again, that's not something that you can just easily apply to everything. It's something you have to be extremely well versed and knowledgeable to know how to apply it properly. But the basic gist of the Shaila is the same as our question here. As we mentioned, you have a woman who's blind, who really, it's not going to make any difference whether or not we go ahead with turning the lights on. But for her, it will make a difference for her own emotional well-being. And that is a very important factor when we talk about violating Shabbos for somebody who is a chole. Rav Moshe Feinstein takes it a little, I'm sorry, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach takes it further. And he says, so let's say I have a patient where all of the critical care is being taken care of, but the patient is in a tremendous amount of pain. So would I be allowed to attach an IV and start the patient on a morphine drip in order to allow them to alleviate that pain? Take a more common example, when you have a woman who's in labor and she wants an epidural. There are plenty of people in the world who have had babies without an epidural. So an epidural alleviates the pain. Obviously, labor is still going to be incredibly painful. But there are plenty of people in the world who deliver children without having an epidural. So what right is there for a doctor on Shabbos to administer an epidural when, after all, it's just pain management? It's just pain management. And the answer is, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, that pain is very, very important when it comes to a chole sheyesh basakana. Sometimes, he writes, a person can actually die from pain, right? We say it as a euphemism. Oh, I'm dying from pain. Sometimes it's true. People can spiral out of control physically because of the emotional pain that they're having. And therefore, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, if you have an opportunity to alleviate a chole sheyesh basakana's pain on Shabbos, we would do that and we would have no hesitation in doing so at all. And I think that that is a very critical point that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach makes, and it's something that we really need to think about very, very carefully and what the extensions of that can be as well. Question, yeah?
How would this apply to going with someone in, let's say, an ambulance on Shabbos if you're not the one who pays, or sometimes they don't let that and having to like drive separately from the person who's
on the unit? So again, you want to know how does this apply to going along with somebody who's a chole sheyesh basakana? So you have somebody who's really sick, and you're concerned that, I mean, they're conscious, they're not conscious. We'll say both, right? So if they're conscious, and you feel that this is something that they will appreciate, it will alleviate the amount of stress that they have to be together with you, then it would be permissible. I remember a number of years ago, it was more than a number, it was before I got married, so I remember that one Friday afternoon, we were about to leave the house for Shabbos. For shul. I was with my father, and somebody called my parents' home from Canada. They had a son who was learning in the yeshiva in New York, and he had had some kind of freak accident on Friday afternoon, a terrible accident in Brooklyn, and he ended up in one of the local hospitals, I think it was Mount Sinai in the city, and he was very, very critically injured. And the parents called from Canada that obviously, you know, he was taken by Hatzalah, they took care of him and whatever it was. But the parents wanted to know, what do they do? Do they just stay in Canada and let the hospital just take care of their son? And my father told them that they should get on a flight on Friday night. They should fly to New York because a patient nowadays needs an advocate. And here you have your 18-year-old son who's in a coma, who, first of all, if he wakes up and doesn't see his parents, who knows what's going to happen. If he wakes up, even if he doesn't wake up, but nobody's advocating for him, that in itself is not healthy and not safe. You know, a hospital, we're not blaming the hospital, but a hospital is overwhelmed. They have so many patients they need to take care of. And obviously the care is going to be much more hands-on if you're going to have somebody there who's advocating on behalf of the patient. And my father said, he said that he felt there was no real allowance for both parents to go. Of course, the parents would love to be there together with each other. But when you're talking about it from the perspective of the patient, how many people does the patient need? So again, if you feel that both parents are actually going to make a difference, so then great. If you feel that one parent is sufficient, he felt that they were allowed to fly in. And that is what they did. They took a flight Friday night. They landed in New York, went straight to the hospital, and they helped take care of their son's condition. Ultimately, he was okay. But it's something that really made an impression on me because he's in good hands. He's in a good hospital. It's not like he's not being taken care of. But yet, the fact that we're able to get him even better care by being there together with him is something that we do not take lightly. And it's something that we do validate in halacha. And therefore, we would allow them to be mechal Shabbos as well. I remember when It was about 4.5 years ago when Rav Asher Weiss's wife was in Sloan Kettering. So she died 4 years ago in the summertime. And we spent a lot of time together then when he was in Sloan. He was here for months at a time. He stayed by us. And I remember that at the time, he, when it came to her being in the ICU for the first Shabbos, so it was Erev Shabbos, and I remember he had a problem. Why? Because his wife was on so much medication, or she had tubes of different things, and she was not able to verbally communicate during the week. So she was using her phone. She was texting, she was typing, and it comes Erev Shabbos, and he turns to me and he says, "What are we going to do for Shabbos?" Which I was surprised. Why is it even a question? The same thing she does during the week, she should do on Shabbos. So he said, "Yeah, but let's try to figure out, you know, what can we do?" So it just so happened, there was a from ICU doctor who was on one of the lower floors. He came up to say hello, and it's Erev Shabbos, so Rav Asher Weiss asked him, "So what do you do with patients on Erev Shabbos when they have this issue that they can't speak? What do you tell them to do?" He says, "Well, I never thought of it. But let me go back down." He worked on the pediatric floor, so he went back down to pediatrics. He goes through the whole cabinet of toys that they have, and he comes back with an Etch-a-Sketch. Remember those two things, the circles? So he comes back with it, and Rav Asher Weiss is looking at this, and whenever he gives it to his wife, she's like, "Oh, am I going to start spelling with this on Shabbos? Like, you know, until you get one letter out, it's going to take forever." And she was so weak. So that wasn't a good idea. So then he goes back downstairs, comes back up, and he brings up a whole set of ABC magnets with a magnetic board. And he says, "Oh, great, here's the solution. She's going to spell out whatever word she wants to." First of all, she only spoke Hebrew, so like the English letters are not going to help her. And number two, like, also, if you're a chola in bed in the ICU on Shabbos and you're trying to figure out how to get your letters and it's going to take you forever to figure out how to put a whole bunch of letters together on a magnetic board, it's probably not so realistic to do that either. So in the end, he asked me to go out and buy a whiteboard. So I went down the block, I bought a whiteboard with markers, and I asked him, "So what's so special about a whiteboard?" He said, "Well, on Shabbos, the only Isser Ksiva that there is, the only time there's an Isser Midah Araisa to write, is when it's a Ksiva Shel Kayama, when it's something that's going to last." But he said, "If you're going to use a whiteboard, that's considered a Ksiva She'ena Shel Kayama." So I said, "Why is that Ena Shel Kayama?" Anyone understand my question? A Ksiva Shel Kayama means, if things remain the way they are, this is going to last. No? So if I write with a pen on a piece of paper, I would say that's a Ksiva Shel Kayama. If I write with a pencil on a paper, the fact that I have the ability to erase it, does that make it a Ksiva She'ena Shel Kayama? Anybody agree with my question? Okay, thank you. I mean, what we say seems to be irrelevant, but I was very surprised. I said, "Why is that a Ksiva She'ena Shel Kayama? You're writing on a whiteboard. So long as you don't do anything to the whiteboard and you don't take the eraser, it's going to be there forever. So why is that Ksiva She'ena Shel Kayama?" So he said, "No, it's still Ksiva She'ena Shel Kayama because it's made to be erased. The nature of a whiteboard is that you write on it and then you erase on it. You erase it right afterwards. So that's called, by nature, Ksiva She'ena Shel Kayama," which was a tremendous chiddush. But okay, I stopped arguing. I went to buy it, gave it to him, and that's what they ended up using. I shared the chiddush with my father. He thought it was very interesting. But I just thought that was an interesting application of this halacha. And I think the bottom line would have been, if the whiteboard wouldn't have been comfortable for her, she would have used her phone. Of course, because you need to make sure that a chola is going to be comfortable on Shabbos. And by limiting them in that way, and not allowing them to have a situation where they're going to be able to communicate freely, is something that may, in some way, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, impact the medical condition that they're in as well. So that's something we always need to be thoughtful and mindful of also. Yeah.
If you had not been able to go out and get the whiteboard and she had been using the phone on Shabbos, what had what extent would Rav Asher Weiss have had to use his phone on Shabbos to answer his wife? Meaning, like, should they have given her, like, his phone to the doctor so that that's who she could communicate with? Or, like, would he be able to write?
Oh, no. What I meant is she was just texting she wasn't texting anyone. She was just writing on a notepad, on a notepad on the screen. That's the way she was communicating, yeah. So let's take an example that's not directly related to Shabbos. Let's try to transfer it to Yom Kippur. Okay, so here's the Shaila. This is a fascinating Shaila that actually happened in Eretz Yisrael, in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. So there was a man who was a Holocaust survivor, And he was in his 90s. And he had the early onset of dementia. And he was, because of that, he was a little bit disoriented, but not disoriented enough that, you know, that he wasn't present. So he was able to have conversations. He was able to recognize his children when they came. But certain things were just confusing to him. He wasn't completely aware. That was aside from his physical condition, which was life-threatening at the time. So his kids knew Yom Kippur was coming. The doctor said he cannot fast on Yom Kippur. There was no chance that the father would be able to fast on Yom Kippur. And they were trying to figure out what were they going to do. So the children decided to come up with the following scheme. They said, well, if we're going to show up on Yom Kippur in our Yom Tov clothing, the father's going to know that it's Yom Kippur. So how about we come in a polo shirt and shorts on Yom Kippur, visit the father. They had a rotation every day. Different children came. And this way, the father won't even think that it's Yom Kippur, and they're going to serve him the meals like they serve him every other day. So that was the plan. Son shows up, turns to his father. He says, "Nu, how's it going?" Father says, "Everything's fine." Father turns to him and he says, "Why are you dressed like this? It's Yom Kippur." The son turns back to him. He says, "No, you're so confused. It's not Yom Kippur today. You got it all wrong. That was next week, last week. It's not Yom Kippur today." Father says, "Don't try to play with me. I know I have dementia, but I know that it's Yom Kippur. I've been following the calendar. I know that it's Yom Kippur today." Son says, "No, it's not. Look, I brought you a sandwich." He presents his father with the sandwich, tells his father to eat it. Father says, "I know you're trying to trick me. It's Yom Kippur. I'm not going to eat it." Son keeps going back and forth. Finally, the father turns to him and he says, "Really, wise guy? You're telling me it's not Yom Kippur? So how about you first eat the sandwich, and I'll take the next bite?" So here's an amazing shot. Would I be allowed to eat on Yom Kippur because I'm trying to help a patient who needs to eat on Yom Kippur feel comfortable to do so? So I'm not administering medical treatment. I'm not really doing anything medically that's going to change the situation. But am I allowed to do something that's going to help in some way for the patient to feel comfortable to do what they need to do on Shabbos or on Yom Kippur? And that really is what I believe a very fascinating but important shaila that we need to think about as well. Sometimes when we say kill a Shabbos for saving a life, it's not as black and white as one may have otherwise thought. Sometimes it entails being a little bit more creative. And sometimes it means we need to do things that are going to help this patient be able to get through the experience of Shabbos and not only being helped by the doctors themselves. So just again, something fascinating to consider, something interesting to think about. Let us move on to another very interesting shaila. And the reason why this is so meaningful to me, this one, is because this actually was a question that was presented from Johannesburg in South Africa. When one of those weeks that I was with Rav Asher Weiss in the hospital 4.5 years ago, actually I was there when this call came in. So it was from one of the Rabbanim in South Africa, and they had the following question. And I think it's something interesting to think about, but what was most fascinating to me was, here he got a shaila from Johannesburg. Basically, this is what was going on every day. We were in the hospital every day together, and he was getting his regular phone calls, like any other day in the office, and he would basically ask me every night when I went home, "Can you bring me back this sefer and this sefer and that sefer tomorrow? I need to look up this, I need to look up that." And he wrote dozens of tshuvas in the hospital. Dozens. And one of them was this. This was actually written in Sloan Kettering. I was there. But at the time, before it was written, just to watch the thought process and the development of how a tshuva comes to be is fascinating in and of itself. And I'll show you this example as one, but really just to give us an appreciation for when a gadol makes a psak, how much goes into it. And sometimes, like they say, mimerchak tavi lachma, sometimes the answer is not exactly where you think. You have to be creative to find where the answer can be. It may not be in the place in Shulchan Aruch where you may have been looking. So let's see. The question is as follows. Ze shanim. Everybody with me? Number gimel?
Everybody here? It's good.
Ze shanim. So it's been many years, he says. She'ergun Hatzalah po'ol bi'erichem bi'hitztainut. He says, you have a organization called Hatzalah in South Africa, in Johannesburg, and they work with excellence. V'zachu l'hatzil nefashos rabos mi'redah sha'ol. And they have saved so many lives. Ah, however, he says, la'acharona, recently, hechlitu al shultonos la'achmer bilimudei ha'ashara. The government in Johannesburg has made a new rule. I'm sorry, in South Africa. What's the new law? The new law was that they said, Me'ata, lo yuchal ish lasok b'hatzala, ela im kein asa sheirus bebeit hacholim bitchumim shonim. You're only able to become a registered paramedic, a registered EMT, if you're willing to do shifts, volunteer shifts in the hospital for a certain amount of time. And you have to go through different wards in the hospital and do a little bit here and a little bit there. Now the problem is that it would absolutely require you to work on Shabbos. They said you have to be in the hospital for a full week. No coming in, no going out. You have to stay there for a full week, and only then will you be able to be certified for a paramedic or Hatzalah to be recognized. So what's the shot? And why is this only a shaila in Johannesburg? Why is it not a shaila here? The answer is because there in particular, let's say over here somebody would have a situation where there's a car accident outside, and there happens to be a 911 dispatcher right outside. The ambulance happens to be here on the block. Nobody would object. Nobody would say, I'm not going in the ambulance. Nobody would say, I'm going to wait for a member of Hatzalah. You would go in the ambulance. It so happens that in our community, we call Hatzalah because we know that they come quicker and we know that they're very reliable. But if they're here already, of course, you would use somebody else. In Johannesburg, it's not the case. It's not the case. Why? Because there is so much infection in the hospitals, in the public hospitals. Nobody from the religious community in Johannesburg uses public hospitals. They all go to private hospitals. And as a result of that, I can say with 100% certainty that if I'm going to take a shift for an entire week in a hospital, there's not a single Jew that I'm going to be treating on Shabbos when I'm there. Not one, which is not the case in America. You go to a hospital here, the likelihood that you're going to have a Jew at some point that you're going to be treating is quite high. But not in Johannesburg. So the shaila is as follows. What's the question? The question is, right now, we have enough paramedics, we have enough EMTs who are volunteering as part of Hatzalah. They don't need me. So let's just leave things as is. And we don't need to do anything. And maybe in 5 or 10 years from now, when we have to then train in a new shift of paramedics or EMTs, then we'll worry about it. We'll figure it out then. Or do we say no? We're allowed to be Mechallel Shabbos now. We're allowed to go and take that shift in the hospital now, even though right now we have enough volunteers on the Hatzalah fleet and we really don't need anybody additional. But if we're not going to look ahead and worry about 5 or 10 years from now, we're going to end up having a problem, which is Pikuach Nefesh then. Would we be allowed to be Mechallel Shabbos now for a Pikuach Nefesh much further down the line? A potential Pikuach Nefesh much further down the line. It's not something that's Bifaneinu. It's not something that we're confronted with right now. It's something that may play out negatively later on down the line. So would we have an allowance to do so, or perhaps not? What do we say? Interesting question. So where do you look for such an answer? What I found fascinating about this was, again, it's a very involved and complicated answer. However, what I found fascinating was that I watched somebody literally go through all of Shas in their head and try to figure out, how can we bring a proof to this from some area of Halacha? So yes, it's true. I grew up with this in my house. I watch my father do this every day. But it's amazing when you see other people who can do the same thing and you realize how little you are, how small you are, and inadequate. So, he came up with the following idea. He said, the Gemara says in Maseches Baba Kama. Now, does anybody know what Baba Kama is about? Baba Kama is about nezikin. It's about damaging people's property. How does that have any relevance to this? You'll see in a moment. The Gemara says in Maseches Baba Kama that there were certain haircuts that the Jewish community used to get back in the day. And there were haircuts that only the Ovdei Avodah Zarah used to get. It was an expression of their service to their God, the kind of haircut that they got. It was called L'saper Kumi. I don't know exactly what kind of haircut it was, but it was something that really designated you as an Ovdei Avodah Zarah. So the Gemara says that there were Mekurave Malchus. There were people who were politicians, and they had to rub shoulders with the local government officials. And they were always negotiating on behalf of the Jewish community. So the Gemara says that even though there's a biblical prohibition, there's an Issur D'oraisa for a Jew to get that haircut because it's B'chukosei and Lo Seilechu. It's actually showing that I value the ways of Avodah Zarah. So under normal circumstances, I wouldn't be allowed to do so. However, the Gemara says, Mekurave Malchus, if I'm one of those people who is a local politician and I need to fit in with all the people that I'm going to be negotiating with, then the Gemara says, I have a special dispensation and I would be allowed to get that haircut even though I'm violating an Issur D'oraisa. That's what the Gemara says in Maseches Baba Kama. Now, does it mean that there's going to be an issue that the Jewish community is faced with right now and therefore I need to get the haircut? No. No. The Gemara's concern is that 5 years down the line or 10 years down the line, we're going to have some problem. And if we don't have these relationships that are something that we're familiar with and comfortable with, if we are not welcome in the halls of Congress, then when we do have an issue that's confronting the Jewish community, we're not going to have any ability to take care of ourselves. So what do you see from there? What do you see? Exactly this point. Sometimes we would allow a person to violate an Issur D'oraisa now, even though it's not to take care of a problem that they're faced with right now. It's to take care of a potential problem 5 or 10 years down the line. Right now it's not relevant, but maybe it will be relevant down the line. I'll tell you a great example of this that I think is fascinating. It's fascinating because it's so important and it's so interesting for us to know that there are people in our world who are facing the same set of circumstances. So there's a woman I'm friendly with. Her name is Cindy Bernstein. Anybody knows who she is? No? Why would you know who she is? She happens to be the chief of staff of Kamala Harris's administration. She is an Orthodox woman, a married woman who lives in Washington, D.C. She is completely from Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus, Shomer everything. And we talk from time to time about different issues that come up when she has a conflict between Judaism and what she's asked to do in the White House. She happens to be scheduled to come to us for Shabbos, so if any of you want to come, she's going to speak in the Young Israel. I think it's fascinating for people to hear this and to see how there are issues that people are faced with today that are really critical issues, but yet you can still be a very powerful woman doing very powerful things and yet keeping very strong to your roots and to your Judaism. So the question that she asked me was as follows. When the war broke out in Ukraine, which was already, unfortunately, so many months ago when it started in March, or even a little bit before that, but in March is when the question came in. So she wanted to know, the vice president was making a trip to Poland to convene world leaders to discuss what they were going to do to help Ukraine. Now, she told me at the time that the way it works when the vice presidential delegation goes anywhere and they have different assignments that they need to do, so they basically assign each major member of the delegation to do something. They're not all in one meeting. Each one is meeting with whoever they need to meet with. And then on Air Force One, Air Force Two, whatever it's called, when they fly back, that's when they have the follow-up meetings to all discuss all the information that they got, all the discussions that they had, and they collaborate and they try to plan afterward with all the information that they then have. That's the way it goes. If you're not on that flight going home, if you're not in those follow-up meetings, it's clearly you weren't there at all. You're worthless. To go show up 2 days later and share the information is no longer relevant. That's when they do all the debriefing, that's when they have all the conversations, and that's when they strategize what to do with whatever the trip was meant to do. So her question was as follows. Vice President was going to Poland. She was asked to go along because she's a major part of the administration. And she wanted to know whether or not she's allowed to fly home with them because they were going to fly home on Friday night and land here on Shabbos. Any takers? So, to tell her that she should fly home Matzah Shabbos, she may as well not go at all. To tell her to fly home on Shabbos is certainly something that entails Chilul Shabbos. So what would you say? These kinds of questions come up every single day. And I think it's important for all of us to appreciate and to realize that there are people working on such questions. These are real life scenarios. These are real questions that come up. And the halacha is what to say about everything. So, I told her, are you aware of the fact that the Gemara has a category of people that are referred to as Mikurave Malchus? Mikurave Malchus is actually describing you. When we talk about the Jewish politicians who need to go along with the program, and the Gemara says in Bava Kamma, they're allowed to get this Avodah Zarah haircut because we need to make sure they feel comfortable in the halls of Congress, wherever they may have been, why are you any different? This is you. The whole Mikurave Malchus discussion is you. And if there's a remote possibility that because of your joining them, you're going to be able to save lives, Jews or non-Jews, but we think you're going to be able to save lives and make a difference in this horrific calamity that's going on in Ukraine, then of course you should go. And of course you should go. Now in the end, she decided not to. And the reason why she said is because she was concerned. If she's going to go, she said they're extremely respectful of her Judaism in the White House. And they've never given her a problem. The problem is now, if she's going to go, they're going to say, well, next Shabbos when we need you, how come you're not available? Why are you saying that you keep Shabbos when you came with us on the plane? So I said to her, well, you're going to have to explain to them the difference between Pikuach Nefesh and not Pikuach Nefesh. She said she's not sure there's such lamdanim to be able to understand the difference between, well, it's Pikuach Nefesh, it's life-saving, this, that, what about answering the phone other times? It's a fascinating issue. There's a woman whose name is Anne, Chani Neuberger. She's actually on the board of Stern College. You know what she is? You should get to know these people. You should get to know these people. These are great women. Actually, next semester, Cindy Bernstein, who I was just talking about, wants to teach a class together with me. I'm not sure how we're going to do it. She's in Washington, D.C., and I'm here. And I also don't have time to prepare a curriculum for this, but she does want to teach a class together about all these kinds of issues, to actually present the cases and figure out how people can learn, not only for someone who wants to go into politics, but for someone who wants to advance in any career, to understand you're going to be confronted with real life issues. Anyway, Chani Neuberger is an amazing woman. Google her for a minute, you'll see what she does. Somebody knows what she does? Anne Neuberger is her name. What? NSA. Very good. Very impressive. She is an Orthodox woman who lives in Baltimore. Yeah, what does she do? Look it up. Yes. She has a major job on the administration right now. What does it say?
It says she serves as Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology in the Biden administration.
Huh? Not bad, right? Not bad. She's an Orthodox woman. I had a meeting in the White House 3.5 months ago, and I sat down with her. We were talking about a number of things, and in the middle, we were talking to her about, you know, so what happens when you have a conflict with Shabbos? She says, they've never had a problem. I have an assistant. They know they can call the assistant, but if there's an emergency, they know they can call me. So we asked her, was there ever an emergency? She said, yes, there was an emergency. And they did call her on Shabbos, and it was actually a national emergency. And this woman was being called on Shabbos because she had to take care of a national emergency that was catastrophic. So this is amazing. It's an emerging field, and I think it's important for all of you as young women aspiring to do whatever it is that you'd like to do in your lives to think about the fact that there is a cadre of Orthodox women who are in the workforce, who are making major contributions, and doing it all al taharas hakodesh, doing it all based on the principles and laws that halacha dictates for all of them. And I think it's inspiring, I think it's enriching, I think it's uplifting to meet them, to hear their stories, and to really understand that it's something that should be a possibility for all of you as well in whatever fields you plan to go into. You can be the top of your fields, you can be the best of the best, and you can continue to strive to be good Orthodox practicing Jews nonetheless. So it's something interesting. How did we get there? It's relevant to this because we spoke about the fact that sometimes you have Mikurave Malchus, and they're allowed to do something which is a remote possibility of Pikuach Nefesh down the line, and yet we're allowed to do that because we have to think about those possibilities as well, even now, even from this perspective where we are today. So all of this is with regard to the first category, which is somebody who is a chole, who is a real situation of potential pikuach nefesh. That is, we're allowed to do things for them, not only to save their life, but also to alleviate their pain, or to do other things that will calm their emotional state down as well. That would also be something that is permissible. The Shulchan Aruch then discusses a second category, which is referred to as sakanas eiver. Sakanas eiver means, a person's life is not in danger, but if we don't take care of this, you're going to lose function of that limb. So let's say somebody has some kind of injury to their eye on Shabbos, And if it's not taken care of immediately, they're going to lose eyesight. They're going to lose the ability to see in that eye. Somebody breaks a leg. If they don't take care of it, who knows? You know, it's not going to heal. They're not going to be able to reset it later on. So the Rishonim discuss, what is the status of Sakana Saver? I'm not even going to get into the discussion because it's been pointed out by many of the great poskim today that there really is a very limited situation of where you ever have Sakanas Eiver today where it's not really a Pikuach Nefashos. Take for example, somebody breaks a leg, so you'll say, okay, so they're going to lose, I mean, I'm not making light of it, but so they'll lose function on that leg and therefore we shouldn't be Mechalel Shabbos on a Nisa Deraisa. The answer is no, because it so quickly can turn from a broken leg to a blood clot, which can then be life-threatening. It could jeopardize their entire body, their entire life. And therefore we assume the Nishmas Adam writes, that this, the Nishmas Avraham writes in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and many others, that there's almost no situation today where you have a Sakanas Eiver, which is not going to potentially lead to a real Sakanas Nefashos. Surprisingly, I just had a situation a few weeks ago where we have a Sakanas Eiver. That's actually an interesting test case. I hope you find this interesting. Anyone here familiar with the fact that there's a possibility today of a woman getting a uterine transplant? You knew that? So that's amazing. There are women who are born without a uterus. I know a woman who was born without a uterus, and it's called MRKH. It's a certain condition, but she has, everything else is fine. She's a fully functioning person, totally good health, and she has ovaries. She just doesn't have a uterus. So she got married, and now she very much would like to have a child. So how can she have a child? The only opportunity for her to have a child, naturally, is if she goes for the uterine transplant. Now, there are very few hospitals in this country that have this opportunity for a uterine transplant. So they happen to be in a very remote location right now, waiting for the uterine transplant. They're actually the next on the list for the next uterus that is available. They will be getting it. And it is amazing that this is where we are. The advances in technology are phenomenal. But that's where they're up to. Now, this hospital does not do live donors. They only do cadaver donors, which means if somebody gets into an accident and has left instructions that they want to donate their organs, so then they will take the woman, and it happens to be that it was a woman in the accident, they'll take the uterus and then offer it to this person. Okay, so far so good. Everybody with me? So here is the shot. They move to this location. The doctors told them, you have to be available at all times. Because we never know. Somebody can get in an accident. We're going to have the organ available to you. You have to be here. Within 10 hours of the accident, within 10 hours of the person coming in, it has to be already, the transplant already has to take place. Okay? So that means you always have to be on call. So she called me before the first Shabbos and asked, what do I do about Shabbos? What do I do if I get a call on Shabbos? Like, am I supposed to carry my phone around with me? And I'm thinking about it. This is a very difficult shaila. So why is it a difficult shaila? Why is it a difficult shaila? Yeah? She's not sick. Somebody who needs a kidney transplant and gets a call on Shabbos that we have a kidney available, of course, you rush to the hospital and take it right away. Because if you don't, the person could die. But here, she can live out the rest of her life living a healthy and happy and fine life. She just won't have a kid. Now, that's a tragedy. And it's going to crush her dreams. But how can we allow Chilul Shabbos for somebody who's not sick? What's the heter? On the other hand, you're going to tell me that a woman is not going to be able to pick up a phone on Shabbos and she's going to miss the opportunity that she's been waiting for to have a uterine transplant all because we can't figure out how to get around the phone issue? It's like hard to imagine such a thing. So what do you say? I thought it was an amazing show. I thought it was an absolutely amazing show. So first of all, what we did was, you know, she said to me, well, I can have a non-Jew. I can have the calls forwarded to the non-Jew. And they can pick it up. And she was going to have one of the previous uterine transplant recipients be the non-Jew who was going to do it on her behalf. So they really talk the lingo, they really understand what it is, and accept on her behalf. Problem with that is, they also give you the medical history of the patient who came in from the car accident. And you have to then talk to your own doctors and make a determination, is this a healthy enough uterus that I want to accept, or perhaps not? Let's say the person was an alcoholic, or the person took drugs and whatever, lived a very unhealthy life, and you don't want to take their organ. So you have to do all that research, and that you can't give over to someone else to do. So what do we tell such a person to do? You're not a cholev. You're not a cholev. So would there be any heter to be mechal Shabbos for such a person or not? I think it's an amazing question. Amazing. I spoke to my father about it. He said right away, in his opinion, it's pashut, it's obvious, that this is a sakana sefer, which is not obvious at all. It's a tremendous chiddush when you think about it. Sakana sefer means if somebody's eye gets injured and they're going to lose the ability to see with that eye, that's sakana sefer, and you're allowed to violate an issur d'rabbanan in order to save that limb. Somebody's leg is going to be injured and it's not going to be able to be repaired later on, so then we're going to be mechal Shabbos midrabbanan to take care of it. But here, why would he call this sakana sefer? He said no. Sakana sefer means if I have the ability to have a functioning limb, and as a result of keeping Shabbos, that limb will not be able to function, that's called sakana sefer. That's an amazing chiddush. That is an absolutely amazing chiddush. And he said that therefore you'd be allowed to violate an issur d'rabbanan for the sake of sakana sefer. So I started off by saying sakana sefer almost never is relevant, because every time you have a sakana sefer, it's basically a sakana to your whole body, and maybe it's going to spiral out of control, turn into something else. Here is a case, which never existed before, of a person who's confronted with a sakana sefer that remains a sakana sefer only. So I mentioned it to Rav Asher Weiss, and I asked him what he thought. So he said, knew what your father say, I told him. So I told him, my father thought it was obvious that it's a sakana sefer. He said, Shai, I love your father. I just disagree with him on one point. It's not pashut. I agree with him in the bottom line that it is a sakana sefer, and we would allow chilul Shabbos for this purpose. But he said, the only point that I disagree with is, let's take a minute to appreciate the chiddush. This is a groundbreaking chiddush that has no precedent in halacha. Never in the history of halacha do we find a case like this, where you have a sakana sefer that is really just of this kind of nature, that if the person doesn't take the Yever, they'll be fine. This is such an unusual case. And I think it's worth appreciating a little bit that we have situations today that we're confronted with that are so beyond anything that was presented in previous generations. Medicine has advanced to such a degree where we have to really think differently. I'll give you another example. I'm going way off topic here. I'm sorry. It's just having fun. So I'll give you another great example. Anyone here ever heard of the medicine basket here in the United States and in every country, basically? In Israel, it's called the Sala Briyut. Wow, you got to educate everybody a little bit. So I'm glad you're in my class. So the medicine basket is basically insurance companies are supposed to cover critical care and medications that we need, correct? But an insurance company cannot cover everything in the world, every possible scenario that ever comes up. The insurance company will go broke. So there has to be some kind of understanding that these kinds of treatments are going to be covered by insurance, and those kinds of treatments will not be. Make sense? Who makes that determination? Who makes that determination?
The insurance company.
What?
The company.
The company, right. So it's called a medicine basket. That there's a team of people that decide based on a whole metric system, I don't know exactly what it is and how they come to the determination, but they basically decide what are we going to cover and how much percentage of the treatments will we cover and what are we not going to cover? What makes sense for us to be involved with and what not? So every time I need to buy a box of Band-Aids, the insurance company is not going to cover it. Why? Because they say, go buy your own Band-Aids. When a person needs a cast, when somebody needs a surgery, the insurance company will cover a percentage of that. So how do we determine exactly what that is? That's left up to this committee, and they figure out every year what exactly should be in and what should be out. In America, it's called the medicine basket. In Israel, it's called the Sal HaBriyut. Same thing. Sal HaBriyut, the medicine basket. So now, the following situation arose. There is a Orthodox Jew for the first time who is on this committee in Israel deciding what should be included in the insurance company's medicine basket and what not. And he wanted to know, how does he cast his vote? When they come to a discussion about what should be covered and what perhaps not, as an Orthodox Jew who follows halacha, how does he put in his vote? What should he say should be included? So if you look at it from our perspective, from a very limited perspective, what would you say? what is the most important value when we're talking about Jewish life, when we're talking about medical treatment? What would you say?
Infertility?
Infertility is important, but not the most important. What's the most important?
Life and death.
The most critical thing that a Jew needs to think about is somebody going to live or are they going to die? Beyond that, we have subcategories of, yes, there are people who struggle with infertility, and of course we should help them. There are people who have broken arms and broken legs and all kinds of different things, and some people need physical therapy. So you have a million different variations, but the most important thing for all of us to think about is critical care for life and death. So would you say, as an Orthodox Jew, that the only thing that should be included in the medicine basket is we should allocate 100% of the funds toward life-saving activity? So if somebody has a heart attack, we're going to cover it. If somebody has something else that's really life-threatening, we're going to cover it. Chemotherapy, we're going to take care of it. Somebody has a broken arm, sorry, you're going to have to live with it. So you want a physical therapy, so you'll never use your arm again. I'm sorry to tell you. I mean, that would be crippling society. Correct? So somebody needs to be in a wheelchair for the rest of their lives because they couldn't get the treatment to take care of their leg that was broken. All right, we're very sorry, but you know, there was somebody else who needed money in order to save their life. He was 99 and a half years old and hanging on by a thread anyway. Yeah, but it's life and death. So here, the 20-year-old who can have a good life ahead of him or her and get the treatment that they need to live a fully functioning, healthy life moving forward is not going to get the treatment and is going to be crippled for the rest of their life on a wheelchair. And the other person who's 99 and a half years old or 119 and a half years old and really is not functioning well at all is going to get the care because that's life and death and this is not? It sounds unreasonable to say that. But based on halakhic criteria, and how do you explain, how do you verbalize, what is the determination going to actually be? So where do you look for such an answer? You think the Rishonim were faced with this question? There were no insurance companies in the days of their Ramban. The Rashba was not negotiating with the medicine basket to figure out what are we going to cover, what are we not. And certainly in the times of the Gemara. So where do you find such an answer? Here's another example. You have the leaders of our generation literally scanning through Shas in their head. I watched it. Figuring out what would be a precedent. What would be a good test case to shed light on this case. What they came up with was, my father said the same thing. What they came up with was a Gemara Maseches Nedarim that has the following discussion. Totally unrelated to our discussion here. I think all of this is unrelated to anything, but I hope it's interesting. So the Gemara says, a machlokes tanaim in the following scenario. You have two cities right next door to each other. Both functioning societies, everybody's doing great, everyone's doing fine. And the Mishnah talks about the situation where one city suddenly runs out of water. They have no water. The other city has plenty of water. So, the Mishnah says the obligation of one city is to share the water that they have, the excess water, with the other city. Makes sense? All right, you should reach out. You should try to help them save lives. Great, sounds wonderful. All right, now it gets a little more complicated. Mishnah says, what happens if I have a situation where one city has enough water to drink and to do the laundry, and the other city doesn't even have drinking water? So are we obligated to give our laundry water for them to be able to drink? For us to give our drinking water to somebody else to survive doesn't make sense. Why? Because why should I die and have them live? I should keep the water that I need for my own sustenance, and then if I have excess, then I give them. But the situation here is that I have enough water not only to drink and stay alive, I have enough water also to do the laundry. So there's a machlokas hatanaim, there's a discussion in the Mishnah whether or not I have to give the laundry water to the city next door. What kind of discussion is that? How can it even be a possibility? You're going to keep the laundry water for yourself when the guy next door is dying? Because he has no water? Does that make sense to anyone? Don't we know that the highest value in Jewish life is not doing laundry? The highest value is pikuach nefesh. There's a pikuach nefesh situation in front of me. And yet I'm ignoring it because I have to do my laundry? So how is that opinion to be understood? And the answer is, perhaps, that while it's true, pikuach nefesh is extremely important, and we need to always think about it and focus on it, when we're talking about a society as a whole and a functioning community, it could just be that there are other factors that come into the equation as well. And it's not, the be-all and end-all is not pikuach nefesh. That's one of the very critical factors. But imagine an entire society without clean clothing. That's also not a functioning society. Will everybody live? Yes. But when we're talking about a klal, when we're talking about a tzibur, when we're talking about a society, there are other things that come to play also. And perhaps that is why one of the opinions in the Mishnah is that if you have enough water not only to drink but also to do laundry, you may not be obligated to give that laundry water over to the people who are going to die of starvation in the town next door. Extrapolate from that to our case. When you're talking about the medicine basket and trying to figure out what belongs in and what perhaps belongs out, while it's true that based on the basic fundamental halachic criterion, the answer should be all of our money, 100% of it, should go to life-saving activities. The answer is, that's not reasonable. We can't have a society where the only people we're going to care for are those who are critically ill. And everybody else who's not is just going to have to suffer the consequence. It doesn't make sense. And perhaps we can learn from a totally unrelated sugya, totally unrelated gemara, totally unrelated discussion about the water, to how we should behave in this kind of situation that we are confronted with. So again, I think it's a fascinating area, fascinating topic. As I said before many times, that learning halacha is something that is constantly changing because we have new situations that arise every single day, and we need to confront those situations and try to give a perspective based on the sources that we know, try to plug in everything from old into the situations of new. So that is with regard to a sakanas eiver. Okay, so far so good. I know we only have 10 minutes left, so let's try to get it in. Enough stories. So then we go into the third category, which is a chola she'ein bo sakana. Who is a chola she'ein bo sakana? Shulchan Aruch says somebody who is mutal mishka, means somebody who's in bed. Okay, so what does that mean? So the Rama says, if I have a child who needs something cooked for them on Shabbos, I'm allowed to ask a non-Jew to cook on behalf of the child on Shabbos, even though it's Amir al-Nakri. I'm not allowed to ask a non-Jew to cook on Shabbos for myself, but if I'm asking for a child, it would be permissible. Why? The answer is, the Rama says we have an understanding, we have an assumption, that children are considered like a chole she'ein lo sakana. What do you mean? Children aren't sick. When a child is sick, they're sick. But when a child is not sick, why do we consider them a chole she'ein lo sakana? The answer is, if you have any younger siblings, or nieces or nephews, you will know that if a child doesn't get what they want, they go berserk. And that's a chole she'ein lo sakana. They're not functioning at the normal capacity that they otherwise would. They don't have enough maturity to understand, okay, if I don't have what exactly I wanted, take it easy, you'll find something else. No, it's not the way children's heads work. And therefore, the Rama says that we would assume you're allowed to violate an Isur D'Rabbanan for, especially an Isur D'Rabbanan of Amir La'akum, you'd be allowed to violate that for a Chol HaShem HaSakana. How do we define a Chol HaShem HaSakana? Somebody who is not able to function in the normal way that they otherwise would. And therefore, the Rama says a child would be part of that category, and it's something to consider. My father extended it and said, based on that, he said he heard in the name of Ramosha Feinstein, someone who's having fertility issues is also a Chol HaShem HaSakana. We'd be allowed to do certain Yisurim D'Rabbanan in order to help a Chol HaShem HaSakana who's trying to have children. Why? Because they're not functioning at the normal capacity that they would otherwise want to. We're not saying that they're not normal. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying a couple who's struggling with infertility is not normal. They want to be able to have children. They are not being able to have that which they feel is the normal course of events for a young couple their age. And therefore, we would assume that going ahead with fertility treatments would be permissible on Shabbos, even though it entails an Issur D'Rabbanan. Now, it doesn't allow you to drive to the hospital. That would be an Issur D'Oraisa. It does allow you to do an Issur D'Rabbanan of Amir L'Nachri and call a taxi if you need to, or something of that nature. So that would be something that we would say is permissible. Let me just see. We have to skip a little bit because we don't have enough time. Yeah, the Shulchan Aruch writes something as well. Oh, my father had an interesting chiddush, which I think is mostly accepted. But let's say you're the kind of person that needs to take caffeine pills, or you need to take sleeping pills. So you're allowed to take those on Shabbos. So what would you say? Why yes? That's your reason. That's it. Yes. Exactly. So that's a modern day extension to the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, which is, if you don't take the caffeine pill, you're going to be a zombie all day. You're not going to function normally. If you don't take the sleeping pill, you're not going to be able to sleep. And then the next day, you're going to have a terrible day. So you're not going to be able to function normally. If you're not functioning normally, then you're allowed to do an Issur D'Rabbanan on Shabbos, and therefore you'd be allowed to take medication. And the same goes if you have a couple where the woman is using a birth control pill. So you're going to tell her, well, she has to abstain from her husband on Friday night because she's not taking birth control pills, and therefore, because she can't take him on Shabbos. What do you mean? That's not functioning in the normal way that she's supposed to be functioning. And therefore, we assume that would be something that is permissible as well. The problem now becomes, we're familiar with the fact that the Shulchan Aruch says there's an issur refuah of the Shabbos. There's an issur to take medication on Shabbos. So who is that referring to? What are we left with? We have the first category, which is a chola sheyesh b'sakana, someone whose life is in danger or potentially in danger. Do anything in the world for them. Be mechalel Shabbos. Go out of your way. Save their life. Save a potential life. All of that is permissible and encouraged. The second category we had was sakana sefer, which we said is almost never relevant. The third category we just said is chola sheyesh b'sakana, someone who's not functioning normally is allowed to violate various Isurim Dirabanan, like Amir al-Nahmi or other things. We would permit them to do that on Shabbos, and they would be allowed to take medication if they're not going to function normally without it. So when the Gemara talks about an Isur Refuah b'Shabbos, you're not allowed to take medication on Shabbos. The Gemara says the reason why is because we're concerned. Anybody know? How do you make medication? You grind it up. That's a Melach HaTochen. So the Gemara says we're concerned if someone's going to end up taking a pill on Shabbos, they're going to end up grinding on Shabbos, which is a malacha, and therefore no medication on Shabbos. Who's that talking to? Who's not allowed to take medication on Shabbos? We just covered everyone. Valid question? Ever thought about it? Answer is, the way my father suggests, I think many say the same thing, but this is his terminology. It's a bari with a mechush ba'alma, which means I'm totally fine. I have a headache. All right. Plenty of times we have headaches. We stay in school. We stay at work. We do what we have to do. We take care of our children. We go out with families. All right. We're fine. I'm not having a migraine where I'm going to be in bed and I'm not functioning. I am functioning. So if you have a bari with a mechush ba'alma, if you have somebody who is healthy, somebody who's okay, they just have what we refer to as a mechush ba'alma, there's something troubling them. They're not 100% the way they otherwise would. In such a case, we assume that is where the Shulchan Aruch and the Gemara tell us that you're not allowed to go ahead and take medications on Shabbos because we're concerned that maybe you're going to come to do the malacha of tochein on Shabbos. So that is with regard to the four categories of chola on Shabbos. I hope this is clear. I see we're ending just on time for everybody. I don't want to hold you up for one extra minute from going on your vacation. But again, if anyone has any questions, please feel free to ask.